Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States, episode 4.33, Common Sense. As the summer of 1775 gave way to the fall, and then eventually the winter, the colonists found themselves going through a crisis unlike any that they had ever seen before. The imperial crisis, of course, had lasted for over a decade, and had profoundly changed the relationship between the colonists and their mother country. However, at the end of 1775, there remained a question of exactly what those changes were. This question would be more or less answered in July 1776 with the Declaration of Independence. Yet, before there can be independence, there must first be a galvanization of colonial interests. Independence required that the colonies have common underlying connections to each other that would meaningfully bind them together moving forward. Thus far in the war, there had been different fights in different parts of the colonies. The war itself, the one that was against the British regulars, was taking place in New England, and now in the Canadian wilderness and overlooking Quebec from the Plains of Abraham. In Pennsylvania, the colonists struggled from the twin pillars of British oppression versus colonial radicalism. Further south, the colonists found themselves fighting to control a slave population that they were convinced was on the verge of a rebellion themselves. These fears were not imaginary either. Both the slave population and the native tribes throughout the colonies found themselves having to make quick decisions about what would be best for them. However, if the theme of this episode is movement towards commonality between the colonists and their struggles, it is clear that we have some work to do. This week, that is exactly what we are going to tackle. We are going to spend our time looking at the colonies in 1775 and moving into 1776, as everybody works to get onto the same page and draw out the things that they all shared. This will culminate in 1776 with the most important pamphlet of the entire Revolutionary era. Beginning today in the Southern colonies, we see a continuation of the same issues that had existed there for much of 1775. There remained the ever-present risk of a slave rebellion, something which the colonists lived in perpetual fear of. Recall that Virginia governor, Lord Dunmore, had threatened emancipation for slaves who fought for the British in the conflict. As we are going to see later today, Dunmore is on the verge of making good on that promise. This was creating some strange tensions throughout the region, and was forcing groups that were historically, and oftentimes actively, opposed to each other to try and find some common ground. This created a situation where even those in the South who remained loyal to the crown had to deal with the question of what they should do if a slave rebellion came. This may well have meant the awkward possibility of loyalists and American patriots having to fight together against a slave uprising. The risk of a slave uprising was not something manifested from colonist paranoia either. Throughout the summer and the autumn, there were frequent reports of pockets of slave resistance. In both of the Carolinas, there were multiple reports of planned slave rebellions, with evidence that some of these were more than mere rumors. That July in Wilmington, news spread of groups of slaves actively plotting an uprising, leading to a general panic. In this situation, both free blacks and enslaved people alike had been discovered collecting weapons and plotting in the nearby woods. In Beaufort, Pitt, and Craven counties, slaves were actively preparing for an insurrection. There was actual credible information found that an uprising was being planned. With all of this, the colonists were pointing the fingers at the governors and blaming the hostilities on them. This was not just in Virginia either, but throughout the Carolinas. Over the coming months, we are going to see more of the royal governors end up fleeing from their colonies out onto warships off the coast, not to escape potential slave uprisings, but rather to get away from those very angry colonists. More than just the slaves, however, there was also the question of the Native Americans. We have spent a lot of time talking about the relationship between the native tribes and the colonists. In fact, we have spent a whole lot of time talking about the sheer dread that the Indians caused the colonists living along the frontiers. Throughout the colonies, there was real fear that these tribes would join the British and rise up against the colonists. There was good reason to fear this as well. American colonists were openly opposed to most acts granting native tribes reservations. Recall that the proclamation line was one of the very first things to occur that kicked off the imperial crisis. More recently, the Quebec Act had threatened colonists' holdings throughout the Ohio country. When rumors therefore began spreading about the British trying to incite Indian tribes to attack the colonists, it was taken extremely seriously. After a colonist was found murdered near Iroquois land, the immediate conclusion was that the murder had been carried out by the Oneida tribe, and was the beginning of a greater campaign. As was the case with the fear of slave insurrection, the idea that the British were trying to recruit natives to their cause was not entirely wrong. John Stewart, the Indian superintendent for the Southern Department, was doing exactly that. There is significant evidence that in South Carolina, Stewart was busy trying to woo both the Catawba and the Cherokee to attack the colony. All of these events, from fear of slave insurrection to the work being done by Stewart to secure Indian alliances, sent shockwaves throughout the American colonies. In several instances, violence had already broken out. In mid-July, the North Carolina governor was forced to flee to Fort Johnstone, as accusations of him attempting to instigate a slave rebellion swirled about. The militia, not having any of it, burned the fort to the ground. All of this is meant to illustrate the tension that existed in the colonies throughout 1775. Yes, George Washington was up outside of Boston, and the major battles of the late part of the year were taking place outside of Quebec. Yet, even in the South, where things seemed on the surface to be more quiet, they were going through the same strife and issues as everybody else. Although you do not end up seeing that weird alliance that we talked about earlier, the Loyalists and the Patriots joining forces against a potential slave rebellion, you do end up seeing other groups coming together for the greater overall fight. Nothing symbolizes this better than in North Carolina, where the old Regulators would end up joining in the fight with many of those same people who they were largely pitted against earlier. We have not talked about the Regulators since episode 4.15. If you will recall, the complaints of the Regulators were pointed towards the colonial elites and their favoritism over urban populations as opposed to the needs on the frontier. Many of these elites now found themselves in leadership positions within the Patriot cause, and they sought to reconcile with the Regulators. This issue was of serious concern, not just in North Carolina where the Regulators were, but up north in Philadelphia. The delegates in Congress realized how tenuous the unity of the colonies was, and the risk of internal dissension from groups like the Regulators posed a real danger to the cohesiveness of the Union. What would emerge was a pattern that would be repeated towards potentially hostile groups throughout the colonies. Patriot leadership would first try to make an appeal to unity, followed by a description of the stakes, and then finally a thinly veiled threat that if they did not get on board with the cause, then they themselves would become enemies. Now, ultimately, this does work with the Regulators. However, I do not bring this up necessarily because I'm concerned with you knowing how Herman Husband and company were doing, but rather it goes to a key point. Just because the war had broken out did not necessarily mend all of those wounds from years before. Internally, the colonies were desperate for unity. They understood the necessity of it, and knew that the stakes were too high to allow for anything else. Ensuring that formerly disenchanted groups like the Regulators were in their camp was critical, because the colonists lacked the ability to be fighting both external threats from the British and internal threats from hostile local groups. By the end of 1775, the royal governors in the South had effectively lost any kind of control. If the colonies still were looking for a kick towards unity, Lord Dunmore would do everything in his power to help them achieve that end. Recall that back in April, Dunmore had enraged just about everybody when he suggested freeing the slaves on the agreement that they come and fight for the British. This threat came mere days before news of Lexington and Concord reached Virginia, and convinced everybody that there was a huge conspiracy afoot. Dunmore had not actually acted on anything, however, during the spring. Really, the threat was just that, a threat. By the end of the year, however, things had changed. In early September, a small battle would take place near Hampton, Virginia. Although it was minor, this was the first engagement of the war south of Massachusetts. The details of the battle are not really that important, because really, it was little more than a minor skirmish. What does matter, however, is the effect that this battle had over Lord Dunmore. The battle had done much to convince Dunmore just how precarious his position truly was. Even before the battle, he had been busily working on forming an army of loyalists in Virginia. One of these regiments was made up of white loyalists. The other, however, was an all-black regiment, called the Ethiopian Regiment. The decision to have an all-black regiment played directly into the greatest fears of the Virginians. Seeing the writing on the wall, Dunmore intended to use these two regiments to secure critical locations, including Fort Pitt, which was formerly known as Fort Duquesne. The Virginian regiments going on an offensive, however, would quickly become secondary to concerns that appeared on November 15th. It was on the 15th that Dunmore announced emancipation for any slave who joined the British Army. This was not a blanket emancipation. It did not apply to slaves that were being held by loyalists, for instance. However, despite this exception, this was still a very, very big deal. This monumental decision by Dunmore came on the same day that his Ethiopian regiment had defeated some 300 colonists at Kemp's Landing near Norfolk. If there was any hope of reconciliation in the South, Dunmore had just poured cold water all over it. He had managed to tap into the deepest fears of the colonists and exploit them. It was much more than mere financial destruction that the colonists were afraid of, too. We have had several episodes of this podcast already, where we have talked about the fact that the colonists everywhere truly feared slave rebellions. They all slept with one eye open, lest their slaves slit their throats in the middle of the night. Now, Dunmore had basically gone ahead and given them the incentive to try and do just that. By the end of 1775, there was no question about the war being something limited to New England. Dunmore had lost any remnant of support that he had maintained and was public enemy number one in Virginia. Despite his proclamation, Dunmore had little actual power over the colony anymore. He had relocated to a warship in the harbor the previous summer. Although he had prorogued the Burgesses months before, they had reformed under the new moniker, the committee, and had taken to the task of governing the colony. When he issued his mid-November proclamation, he forced everybody off of the fence and made them choose sides. No longer was the war isolated to Massachusetts. It had come south. There was no denying the fact that Virginia was now at war. Dunmore would put the icing on the cake when, on January 1st, 1776, he had Norfolk shelled, causing much of the town to burn. The November emancipation by Dunmore is just one example of an event that would help stitch together the different groups of Virginia society. Fear of slave rebellion and Indian insurrections scared everyone. By exploiting these things, the British had managed to unite groups within the colonies who may not necessarily be otherwise politically inclined towards each other. However, these were universal fears that permeated both colonial borders and within the individual colonies, the class relations that then existed. Going back to the example of the Regulators, they did not join the cause because they had any love for the colonial elites on the Patriot side. They really, really didn't. However, they were just as worried about slave rebellions and instability along the frontiers from Indian attacks. Much of the thrust to tie all of the colonies together into a common cause with one another was carried out by the colonial press. The job of the press was twofold. First, their primary job was to help link events throughout the colonies. As historian Robert Parkinson puts it in his book, The Common Cause, why did somebody in Charleston care about what was happening outside of Quebec, some 1,500 miles to their north. It was the job of the papers to help make the colonists in Charleston care about events hundreds, if not thousands of miles away. However, the press had a secondary function as well. They were acting as a filter for the news, which could threaten the unity of the colonies. The goal was to promote unity between the colonies and to shy away from anything that could potentially lead to discord. Colonial newspapers were quick to report claims of British misdeeds. No matter where you lived in the colonies, the threat of Indian violence never strayed far from your mind. Indeed, today we have already talked about John Stuart's attempts to secure Indian alliances for the British in the South. In the North, Guy Carleton, the Indian superintendent of the North, was busy doing the exact same thing. Colonial newspapers were quick to spread this information and make sure that everybody knew of the British actions. Regardless of where you lived, therefore, you were getting information about how the British were making allies with the Indians and convincing them of the merit of terrorizing the frontiers. Everybody remembered the terror along the frontiers during both the French and Indian War and Pontiac's Rebellion. These events were not that far in the past. The colonists did not need to hear of the terror along the Pennsylvania or the Virginia frontier because for anybody who was at least middle-aged, they lived it. Even amongst the younger adults, there was a decent chance that they had been children with actual memories of the attacks along those frontiers. How do you make somebody living in South Carolina or Georgia care about events going on in New England or Canada? You spread news of events that universally terrified all of the colonists. If you live in South Carolina, you care about the actions of Guy Carleton because you can see the wider trend of British actions and consequently worry about men like John Stuart and the Cherokee. When the colonists managed to intercept the personal letters of John Stuart, the letters proved that there was evidence that he was in fact trying to convince local tribes to join the fight. These letters were reproduced and published throughout all of the colonies. This was not mere rumor mongering, but rather was hard, tangible evidence that confirmed the worst conspiracy theories that the colonists held. The newspapers published routine information about troops arriving in the colonies. Sometimes this was accurate information. Other times it wasn't. Although I mentioned that the Stuart letters were more than mere rumor mongering, this is not to say that the publishers were above rumor mongering. These rumors included stories of British plans to offer emancipation for slaves who agreed to fight for their former masters, an emancipation that was greater in scope than what we have seen by Dunmore. Another rumor claimed that the British regretted not sending over Swiss mercenaries to slaughter the colonists. The papers excelled at spreading fear throughout the colonies, fear that came as a direct result of supposed British designs to both enslave and slaughter innocent colonists. Colonial publishers successfully managed to paint a picture that was both deeply concerning while at the same time being easy for the colonists to believe. They were at war with the British. There were troops actively engaged in killing colonists in Massachusetts. Lord Dunmore had threatened to emancipate the slaves if they agreed to fight against their masters. And then in November, he did exactly that thing. Those letters from Stuart proved that the British were trying to recruit Indians into the fight. The stories were believable because the colonists stood as direct witnesses to their veracity. However, if driving the narrative of the existential threat that the British posed was the primary job of the colonial publishers, they did have a secondary task. If the goal was fostering unity between the different colonies, and through the different segments of the population, then publishers would find it necessary to fill the role of gatekeepers of information that would tend to cause disunity. A good example of this early in the war came in September in Boston, when it was discovered that Dr. Benjamin Church was giving information to Thomas Gage. This was a deflating bit of information for the colonists, and threatened to create an atmosphere of distrust amongst colonial leadership. Dr. Church was an inner circle guy on the Boston Committee of Correspondence. Church had been providing the British with troop numbers, positions, and reports of morale. The news was absolutely scandal-worthy and could have proven to be a debilitating shock to the early morale of the Patriot cause. In this instance, therefore, publishers moved into the role of gatekeepers. Only a handful of papers even chose to report on the story of Church's treason, and those that did went out of their way to downplay the event. Historian Robert Parkinson writes that when reports did appear in the colonial papers, it seldom exceeded more than just a few lines of text with little in the way of detail. The treason of Benjamin Church was a big deal, especially at such a pivotal early moment in the conflict. The Americans at this time could not afford to have such a huge defection in their ranks, largely because of the colonial publishers exercising that gatekeeping function. Dr. Church's treason was not a scandal or particularly big news. Just as the publishers were controlling the narrative and creating unity, in the case of Benjamin Church, they instead chose to essentially ignore the story. His duplicity was not a scandal because the printers chose not to make it one. Just as the colonial printers had driven the narrative in spreading information of British plots, they limited the spread of information that would have undermined the cause. As a quick postscript on Dr. Church, he would move in and out of confinement until 1778, when he was officially banished from Massachusetts. Following his banishment, he left New England with plans to head to the Caribbean. That was the last that anybody ever heard from him. The ship was never heard from again and presumably sank somewhere along the way, taking Dr. Church with it. The Americans were not the only ones busy trying to control the narrative either. The British had been equally as active, at least back in London. However, even within the colonies, we do see the spread of the occasional loyalist polemic. When William Campbell came over and took over as the governor of South Carolina, he brought with him copies of a work by John Dalrymple, called The Address of the People of Great Britain to the Inhabitants of America. The piece was essentially a warning to the American colonists that their current machinations were driving them towards total ruin. This pamphlet would become a popular piece of writing amongst the Loyalists. Campbell openly spread the pamphlet throughout South Carolina. When our missionaries we discussed earlier came to try and rein in the former regulators, they often found that the crowds that they were speaking with were aware of Dalrymple's work, and were often more than happy to throw it back in their faces. Although it was true that there were efforts being made on both sides to paint the cause to their own desire through the medium of print, here the Americans were always going to have the advantage. This is largely a matter of pure logistics. If the goal of the Americans was to foster a common cause between the colonies, that is going to be much easier to accomplish than, say, the British attempting to publish Loyalist works. The war was being fought in North America, where the Americans controlled the roads, and as a function of that, had a far easier job of controlling the spread of information. The British, on the other hand, were having to largely smuggle their works in from across the ocean, and then move them through far less efficient distribution networks. By far, the most galvanizing piece of literature that would emerge throughout the entire war itself, or the preceding imperial crisis, was published in January 1776. Common Sense by Thomas Paine was an absolute game changer. It did more than anything that had come out previously at framing what the colonists were doing. It made it crystal clear what it was that they were fighting for and what they were fighting against. Thomas Paine was not some lifelong suffering colonist. In fact, he had not lived in the colonies for the vast majority of the imperial crisis, rather having immigrated from Great Britain after multiple failed business ventures, arriving in Philadelphia on November 30, 1774. This was, as a reminder, right at the height of the crisis surrounding the Tea Act, and just a few weeks before the Boston Tea Party. Of course, Philadelphia was not spared from the radicalism of the moment in 1774, as Philadelphians would also turn away tea under the threat of violence. Back in London, Paine had met Benjamin Franklin through a mutual friend. Taking a liking to the young man, Franklin provided him with a letter of introduction to his son-in-law, Richard Bache. Soon after settling in the colonies, Paine would find a particular talent at writing, and would become a contributor to the Pennsylvania area newspapers. What Paine would end up producing would become one of the most read works in all of American history. The pamphlet is short, only around 50 pages. However, in that time it would launch a radical attack against British actions. Whereas there had long been a hesitance, even after everything that had taken place in 1775, to attack the monarchy, Paine had no such reservations. Common sense lambasted the monarchy and the entire concept of hereditary succession. Paine writes, "Male and female are the distinctions of nature, good and bad, the distinctions of heaven. But how a race of man came into the world so exalted above the rest and distinguished like some new species is worth inquiring into, and whether they are the means of happiness or misery to mankind." Paine openly condemns the concept of hereditary succession. On government in general, Paine writes, "Society in every state is a blessing, but government, even in its best state, is but a necessary evil. In its worst state, an intolerable one. For when we suffer, or are exposed to the same miseries by a government which we might expect in a country without government, our calamity is heightened by reflecting that we furnish the means by which we suffer." After Paine spends the first two parts of the pamphlet laying out his argument against both the English Constitution and the idea of monarchy in general, he lays out the American crisis in plain language. Paine writes that, "I have heard it attested by some, that as America hath flourished under her former connection with Great Britain, that the same connection is necessary towards her future happiness, and will always have the same effect. Nothing can be more fallacious than this kind of argument. We may as well assert that because a child has thrived upon milk, that it is never meant to have meat, or that the first 20 years of our lives is to become precedent for the next 20. But even this is admitting more than is true, for I answer roundly that America would have flourished as much and probably much more had no European powers had anything to do with her. The commerce by which she hath enriched herself are the necessaries of life and will always have a market while eating is the custom of Europe." What Paine wrote in Common Sense struck a nerve. It got to the point that there was no real hope in reconciliation, and that any such attempt would do nothing but hold the growth of the colonies back. Paine argued not just for the independence of the colonies, but it urged people to look beyond historical ties and systems. Common Sense was as radical as it was simplistic. As historian Richard Middlecuff states in his book, The Glorious Cause, what Paine wrote in 1776 was, again, nothing new. It was the same rhetoric that had been coming out of the colonies for years, taken to its logical conclusion. Common Sense argued that same key tenet, that the British were conspiring to enslave the colonies. Where Paine extended the argument was that he refused to separate the actions of the king from those of Parliament, instead arguing that the king and Parliament were all a part of the same British constitution, and that they were inseparable. There was no going back. There should not be hope for reconciliation, because reconciliation would only exacerbate the problems that had caused the conflict in the first place. The only option on the table for the Americans was independence from Great Britain. The colonists were ready for this kind of radicalism, too, by the beginning of 1776. By the time that Common Sense was published, it had become clear that the king was not the protector of the colonists. Recall back to the Olive Branch petition that we had talked about back in episode 4.31, the one that John Dickinson felt necessary while others, like John Adams, felt foolish. As it turns out, George III was not interested in anguished pleas or praise from the colonies. He didn't even read the petition. Rather, just a few weeks before, after he learned of what had happened at Bunker Hill, the king declared that the American colonies were in rebellion. George III had made clear to the colonists that he was not going to save the American colonies from an overreaching parliament. Instead, he was planning to wage war on them. What Thomas Paine had done is that he had managed to portray the American cause in easy-to-understand language. Quickly, it spread throughout the colonies and ultimately back to Europe and beyond. The work made clear that British interests and American interests had diverged. Common sense helped further galvanize an American population that was steadfastly turning away from thoughts of reconciliation and towards the now very real question of American independence. Critical in the scope of our episode today, common sense was not something being addressed to one particular group either. It was not meant for Philadelphians, Virginians, Bostonians, or anybody else. The pamphlet was meant to cut across geographical and class divides. In the very real struggle to bring different groups together for the common American cause, common sense did just that. This is not to say that common sense did not face some pushback. Not everybody was enamored by Paine, nor his radicalism. There is no doubt that in a moment where there remained a real skittishness towards calling out the king directly, Paine threw caution to the wind. Thomas Paine was not suggesting a new version of the British Constitution, with a new king inserted into an American parliamentary structure modeled on Great Britain. Paine was outright rejecting monarchy altogether. The colonies were therefore left to grapple with the idea and question of what a constitution was and, far more than just independence, the real question of what were they fighting for. Paine was calling for an outright rejection of old customs and urged people to not simply accept the same customs because they were familiar with those customs. In other words, don't have a monarch simply because you always have had one. Detractors of Paine argued that those customs and virtues is what gives a system, as historian Bernard Balin states, their purpose and direction. Gordon Wood points out, however, that even Thomas Paine, who had rejected the concept of monarchy and hereditary succession so thoroughly in Common Sense, would, less than a year later in the American crisis, harken back to those ancient relationships, then describing the American colonies as a people who had simply grown up from their mother country and needed to leave the proverbial nest. Common sense, as we are going to see more in the coming weeks, would prove invaluable to the rapidly expanding independence movement. Over the course of 1776, over 100,000 copies of the pamphlet would be sold in North America. Lower literacy rates meant that not everybody had the ability to read it themselves. However, many more than that 100,000 would hear Paine's words from having the work read to them. The pamphlet spread throughout the classes and was read by the wealthy, the powerful, lawyers, artisans, shopkeepers, farmers, and peasants. In that quest to form a common cause, some underlying current that would tie everybody together from north to south, Paine had struck gold. Even amongst those who personally disliked Paine and common sense, and very specifically I'm talking about John Adams here, he could not fail to miss the effect that it had. For those who had been stuck hoping for reconciliation, common sense came along and so clearly synthesized why that was no longer a tenable solution. It helped tie the colonies together in a greater battle to prevent their enslavement at the hands of both an overreaching parliament and a duplicitous king. Even if Adams disliked the work, for somebody who was such an early proponent of independence, common sense provided him with the gift of helping to galvanize and prepare the population for a final, irrevocable break with Great Britain. We are going to return to common sense often over the coming episodes, as the colonies begin their steady march towards July 4th, 1776. as we move through the end of the Revolution and into the tumults that would hit the early Republic next season. We will again find ourselves hearkening back to Thomas Paine and how his work played into all of it. Before I completely wrap up for this week, I wanted to point out a source that I leaned heavily on for this episode. I am talking about the book, The Common Cause, Creating Race and Nation in the American Revolution, by Robert Parkinson. If you have found the topic of today's discussion interesting and want to dive deeper into the subject, I highly recommend the book by Parkinson. I merely tried to scratch the very surface of Parkinson's work in this episode today. His book helps to really explain how the colonies would find a common cause with each other, while laying the groundwork for future events. So, if you're wanting to go deeper into the subject, that is a great place to start. Next time, as whispers of independence begin to grow louder and more organized, the war marches on. In Boston, however, the war would come to a sudden and seemingly unexpected end. With that, I hope you all have an excellent 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time for the liberation of Boston.